Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president and a current member of the club's Board of Governors. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Ahmed Rashid, Pakistani journalist and writer, senior fellow on international policy at the Pacific Council. Ahmed Rashid is one of Pakistan's leading journalists and an expert on the Taliban and Islamist militancy. Previously, Mr. Rashid was the longtime Pakistan and Afghanistan correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. He currently writes for the Washington Post, the International Herald Tribune, the Wall Street Journal, and the Daily Telegraph of London. He appears regularly on CNN, National Public Radio, and the BBC World Service. Mr. Rashid is a scholar of the World Economic Forum and a consultant for Human Rights Watch. He is the author also of a number of well-regarded books about South and Central Asia, including most recently Descent into Chaos, The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. Now, this book was published in 2008. His previous books include two international bestsellers, Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil and Fundamentalism in Central Asia, and Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. You know, the timing of this program really couldn't be better. It recently has been disclosed in the media that not only has President Obama floated the idea of negotiating with moderate elements of the Taliban, but the Afghan government has also been exploring the potential for negotiations with the Taliban Leadership Council of Mullah Muhammad Omar and with certain other renegade leaders of the Taliban as well. So sit back and enjoy today's program as we welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California journalist, author, and scholar Ahmed Rashid.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very great pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming in the middle of a beautiful day in which you would probably rather be sitting out than listening to me. You know, there has been a lot of skepticism in the media recently, commentators calling the President Obama's surge in Afghanistan, Obama's Vietnam, the Americans will suffer the same defeat like the Soviets did, like the British did in the past century. Now, I would basically, you know, try and rectify that in some form. And certainly, this administration has made it very clear that the crisis in Pakistan and Afghanistan is the most immediate and the biggest challenge that it faces. And that's why we are seeing right now a rush to produce a policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan, which has to be ready for the NATO summit on April 2nd. And you are seeing also an amazing amount of conferring with allies. India and Pakistan have both been in Washington recently, the foreign ministers having input into this policy, whatever emerges. The Indian foreign secretary has just arrived in Washington. Hillary Clinton has called for a meeting at the end of March, which will include Iran, and put Americans and Iranians opposite each other for the first time. Joe Biden has just gone to NATO to talk to NATO allies. So there's an incredible flurry of diplomatic efforts. And I think what is most marked is that, you know, under the Bush administration, we saw, you know, the policy was being made in the Pentagon largely, not even necessarily in the White House, being made in the Pentagon and then being the allies literally literally being told what the policy is, and that they either cough up troops or cough up money for this policy. Here we are seeing a very different, a much more multilateral rather than a unilateral attitude of conferring. Now, what is, you know, why is this region so terrifying and such a challenge? Well, the first is that the Afghan Taliban have reemerged in Afghanistan, as you know. How did we get, I'll deal with how did we get from 9/11 when the Taliban were routed to where we are now, where the Taliban control something like one-third of Afghanistan. Not only that, but the Taliban have now spread into Pakistan. They have become a regional role model for extremism. Today you have Afghan Taliban, you have Pakistani Taliban, and you have Central Asian Taliban, who are fighting out of Pakistan and Afghanistan and laying the seeds for further unrest in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan. So the Taliban is now becoming a regional problem, and therefore it becomes imperative that the solution or the in order to combat this, you have to have a regional policy. You cannot just have a policy confined to the four walls of Afghanistan. The major result of this is that development and nation building in Afghanistan has got paralyzed. The NGOs have pulled out. The UN has pulled out of large areas of the country. There's very little economic activity. The roads are not safe, etc. Government capacity has diminished. The government in Kabul, which had been slowly trying to build up some capacity in the provinces, has absolutely diminished. The global terrorist threat has increased enormously because Al-Qaeda has had these safe havens along the border with Pakistan and Afghanistan. They have been very well protected by their Taliban hosts who are expanding the territory for Al-Qaeda so that Al-Qaeda feels even safer. Mostly that expansion is taking place in Pakistan, which is creating enormous worries. And what is the position of Al-Qaeda? Well, just before 9/11, Al-Qaeda did not have branches or offices in major European countries. They had some influence in Britain and perhaps in Germany, but where, of course, Mohammed Atta, the group, came from. Today, Al-Qaeda has supporters or branches or neo-Al-Qaeda branches in every single European country. If you just look at the arrests that have taken place over the last 6 months, they've taken place in Spain, in France, in Germany, in Britain, in Denmark. There's even supposition that Al-Qaeda is trying to move into Eastern Europe, into Poland, and into other such places. And certainly there have been, Europe remains, I think, the most vulnerable place at the moment for an act of terrorism. And there have been several that have been foiled and several that have been carried out, such as the Madrid bombings and the London bombings and other things. Al-Qaeda has also expanded in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia, in Somalia. A lot of this piracy that you're hearing about is being linked now to Al-Qaeda and in the Sudan. Al-Qaeda has set up a separate unit for North Africa and for the Sahara. The only place where it has faced a setback has been Iraq, where it came in as an outside force and it was clearly not popular. But let me just say that as long as Al-Qaeda has these safe havens in Pakistan and Afghanistan, as long as they're being supported by the local Taliban, who have the wherewithal to support them and to provide them refuge and food and sanctuary and all the rest of it, we're not going to get an end to this problem. Now, in Pakistan, the problem probably is more dire. You have three concurrent crises in Pakistan. You have, first of all, the spread of the Taliban. As you know, the Taliban recently signed a peace deal which gave them virtual control of the Swat Valley, which is just 100 miles north of the capital, Islamabad. You have a spread of the Taliban right across northern Pakistan. And now with this recent bombing in Lahore, in Punjab province, you have the spread of Taliban and their allied groups very active in Pakistani cities and in other provinces. The second problem is a huge economic crisis. Pakistan is now bankrupt virtually. It has no capacity to deal the rising unemployment, inflation, etc. It's looking for a big economic bailout from the global community. That's going to be very difficult with your own economic crisis. And that's also going to be difficult because Pakistan's politicians have refused to come together. And that is the third crisis. Right now, there's a standoff between the ruling party, the People's Party of former Benazir Bhutto, and which is now led by her husband, President Asif Zardari, and the leader of the opposition, Nawaz Sharif, who's threatening to march on Islamabad in a week's time, and is threatening to topple the government. And already today, there have been mass arrests in Pakistan to try and prevent that from happening. So you have a political crisis, you have an economic crisis, and you have an extremist Taliban crisis. And I would say that the options for Obama are far more difficult in Pakistan than they are in Afghanistan. Now, let me just briefly tell you, how did we get from 9/11, the routing of the Taliban and al-Qaeda, how did we get from that position of relative U.S. strength and U.S. support around the world, U.S. support amongst the Afghans, etc., to the position today? Well, if I sum it up in one word, that one word would probably be Iraq. Iraq was an enormous diversion of what the U.S. said it would do in Afghanistan. That is, it would rout out al-Qaeda, it would rout out the Taliban, and it would rebuild the country. None of these things were ever done in the last 8 years. And that, of course, has been the most damaging because, you know, part of the reason was Iraq. But I will say another few things. There was never a comprehensive military strategy for Afghanistan. There were too few troops. There were too few resources. Security was left in the hands of the warlords and in the hands of drug smugglers and other such people, rather than security being the central government being strengthened to provide security. There was no intentions of the Bush administration to rebuild and reconstruct Afghanistan, even in the most minimal way, that is provide, you know, rebuild the infrastructure so that the Afghan economy could take off sufficiently so that the government could provide jobs, etc. And what we had instead was a very haphazard rebuilding process where money went to some sectors, didn't go to others, there was no coordination, there was massive corruption in the American contracting process. As you know, big checks were written to the Beltway contractors who subcontracted down the line to Pakistanis and Indians who then subcontracted to Afghans. Everybody was taking their 10%, and by the end of it, you know, of $100, perhaps $30 or $40 was actually reaching the Afghan people. So the present state of corruption in the Afghan government and is partly related to the kind of corrupt practices that, of course, have been exposed far more vehemently in Iraq, where so much American money has been wasted. But I would say, although the sums are much smaller, similar amounts have been wasted, relatively speaking, in Afghanistan. If you read my book, Descent into Chaos, I mean, this is outlined in much greater detail. Lastly, the third aspect, no comprehensive military strategy, no comprehensive reconstruction strategy, and no comprehensive counter-narcotics strategy. For 8 years, the U.S. government has not had a counter-narcotic strategy. It has debated it with its allies, it has debated it within itself, but the bottom line was that Rumsfeld refused to allow the U.S. military to get involved in one of two aspects. There are two ways to do drugs. The first is eradication, which naturally the U.S. military didn't want to do, and many people didn't want foreigners to come up against Afghan farmers. But the other thing was interdiction. And that is catching drug smugglers, catching convoys of drugs that were crossing Afghanistan into other countries. Rumsfeld refused to do this. And only last year, the end of last year, literally about 4 or 5 months ago, has the U.S. military finally agreed to do interdiction. And it is now trying to persuade its NATO allies to agree to the same thing. But it's really left it too late. I mean, Afghanistan today provides 93% of the world's heroin. Which is an amazing figure. And the second aspect of this was that Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush were in total denial about the issue that drugs money was being used by the extremists. Only last year was there an admittance that, yes, actually one of the main sources of funding for al-Qaeda and for the Taliban comes from drugs money. I mean, you know, people like myself were saying this 5 years ago, but there was absolutely no acceptance. Because, of course, if you accept that fact, you have to do something about it. There was a reluctance to do anything about it. So it was convenient to deny that, you know, drugs money was being used by the extremists. And certainly the kind of expansion the Taliban we've seen in the last few years has only been possible because they've been incredibly well-financed. They have the money to buy the guns and the food and pay their... For the first time, the Taliban are paying their soldiers twice the monthly salary of an average Afghan. So when I covered the Taliban in the 90s, when the Taliban controlled Afghanistan, they never paid their soldiers anything. Today, they're paying their soldiers substantially. So I think, you know, this inheritance... And lastly, there was no regional strategy in Afghanistan. In other words, involving the neighboring countries in trying to stabilize Afghanistan. There was a Bush strategy which depended on one country entirely, and that was Pakistan. There was really no attempt to involve the Central Asian states. Iran, of course, was anathema. China, Russia, the Arabs, etc., in making Afghan policy. And Afghanistan is a landlocked country. It has six neighbors. And these neighbors have constantly interfered in Afghanistan. You can't bring peace in Afghanistan without looking at the neighboring countries. And you need the neighboring countries also for supplies to your own troops and for gateways and for transport routes and all the rest of it. Now, this dependence on Pakistan, we had a military regime, and the military regime basically pursued a two-track policy. It went after al-Qaeda, which is what the Americans wanted, but at the same time, it allowed the Afghan Taliban to be hosted in Pakistan. It turned a blind eye to the Afghan Taliban as they remobilized in 2003-2004. And the reason was that the Pakistani military obsession was India. The fact that the Indians had now arrived in Kabul. They were playing an influential role. They had a big aid program in Kabul. And India is Pakistan's rival, of course, for decades. And the dispute over Kashmir, as you know, has led to three wars and the insurgency in Kashmir, etc. And now what we saw happening in the early part of this period was that Kabul, in a sense, becomes the new Kashmir. Kabul becomes the new ground for rivalry between India and Pakistan. So Pakistan accuses India of interfering in the western bordering regions of Pakistan, fermenting unrest in Balochistan and Sindh province, and the Indians accuse Pakistan of trying to kill their personnel in Afghanistan, using the Taliban to kill their personnel. Large numbers of Indians have died. And, of course, the Indian embassy was bombed in June of last year, which American intelligence laid at the door of the Pakistani intelligence services. So, and again, here we have a very, very... I wouldn't say a lack of understanding by the Bush administration, but a refusal to accept the reality on the ground. Again, a state of denial. The military was cabling back to Pentagon, describing exactly what was happening on the ground as early as 2004. But nobody wanted to listen to this because that would have meant either breaking with Musharraf or forcing Musharraf to do more. And in this period, let me tell you, the U.S. gave Musharraf $11.8 billion. Between 2001 and 2007. And 80% of this money went to the military. And the military bought weapon systems aimed at India, F-16, submarines, frigates, hardly stuff that was needed to fight counterinsurgency along its border with Afghanistan or deal with the insurgency in Pakistan itself. And most of that money still is totally unaccountable. The U.S. Congress is now investigating where this money went. Why was this money? Why were blank checks being written? And who wrote these checks? And was, you know, there is not a single receipt of you know, that this money is being spent on counterinsurgency operations. And this money, of course, was totally unaccountable on the Pakistan end by the military regime. So we have this inheritance of a, I wouldn't say just a poor policy, I would say a completely failed policy, where the reality on the ground, both in Afghanistan and Pakistan, was constantly being overlooked. And good advice by the by U.S. intelligence, by the U.S. military, even by U.S. diplomats, was being constantly countermanded. Now, what are the options for President Obama? Well, let me start by a few things. I mean, I described this kind of political flurry of activity that is going on right now. I think there are several things that need to be done on the broad counterterrorism front. He's closed down Guantanamo. Now that is obviously going to create a lot of legal problems, and it's not going to, you know, it's not going to disappear immediately, but it's a first step. I think critical to a more coherent policy in the broader Muslim world and to Afghanistan and Pakistan is that the global war on terror has to be redefined. Bush's interpretation of this global war on terror lumped everyone together. It lumped al-Qaeda, which had an agenda of global jihad and planting bombs in New York, and it lumped groups like the Taliban, the Kashmiri militants, Hamas, Hezbollah, who may be extremist, who I would still call Islamic extreme nationalist extremists, in the sense that they had no agenda outside their particular area of operations or their territory. They were either, you know, fighting against Israel, or they were fighting against India, or they were fighting in Afghanistan. They had no. You have not had the Taliban or Hamas try to plant a bomb in New York or London or Madrid or anywhere else. So to have lumped all these together really restricted the political maneuverability for the U.S. And I think this has to be redefined. I think al-Qaeda has to be isolated at one end of the spectrum as being, you know, unacceptable and militarily having to be, you know, has to be destroyed. And on the other end of the spectrum, I think a mixture of military force, dialogue, persuasion, and we've seen now that Obama has called for talks with the Taliban. And I think this process can start. Now, it's not going to happen overnight. It might take several years before you get any movement on this. But I think what is implied by this is that the Taliban is not a uniform force. There is a leadership which is hardcore, which is very close to al-Qaeda, and which is perhaps indirectly committed to some kind of global jihad. But there are large numbers of commanders and foot soldiers who are fighting for very many different reasons. Somebody's brother was killed, somebody's house was destroyed by a U.S. bomb, somebody is very angry because the reconstruction that was promised them never happened, etc. So I think a lot of these people who have local grievances, either with the Americans or with the Afghan government or with NATO, these kinds of people can be wooed and won over. They can be bribed. They can be given political position. They can be given compensation for their losses. They can be resuscitated in their villages, etc. So I think a lot of options, you know, are open there. So I think redefining the war on terror, talking to the Taliban. Thirdly, there's been a lot of criticism about these 17,000 extra troops. Well, there are two aspects to more American troops. The first is you cannot talk to the Taliban from a position of weakness. And right now the U.S. is losing the war in Afghanistan. You had the president himself say the other day that the U.S. is not winning. Now, that's a polite way of saying that the U.S. is losing. The U.S. is losing the war in Afghanistan. You need to speak from a position of strength. You need to drive back the Taliban. You need to retake some of these areas in order to bring development, etc., so that the Taliban are put on notice that, you know, dialogue would be a good thing. I hope that the new policy will reflect this, is that we do not need just a troop surge in Afghanistan. You need what I call a comprehensive surge. That is a surge on all fronts: economic, reconstruction, speeding up the building of the Afghan army and the police, speeding up the building of the justice system, building capacity in the government ministry so that they can actually function properly. So what we need is a comprehensive surge that should have been launched back in 2001, which was never launched, And of course, this is going to come. I understand that, you know, everything I'm mentioning is going to cost money. And nobody's suggesting here that the burden should entirely fall on the Americans, which is precisely why, you know, all these talks are going on with NATO allies and with other allies to pitch in. Now, but they're only going to pitch in to this comprehensive surge if they become part of the decision-making process, that this policy has some input from them, rather than the way that Bush went about it, which was, you know, here is the policy. I mean, Rumsfeld and all would go to NATO summits and say, well, here's the policy, you know, give us the troops or give us the money to implement this policy. And there was absolutely no discussion with the allies as to where they thought the Americans may be wrong or they may be doing things wrong. So a comprehensive surge. Thirdly, you need to build up capacity in the Afghan government. There is at the moment, there are going to be elections this year in Afghanistan. There may be a new president by August. At the moment, there's a bit of a constitutional crisis going on, which I can go into later if you like. But there are many candidates standing for election. But the key thing is that are you going to have a president who's going to be conscious of the fact that he needs to do something about corruption in the Afghan government, which is fueled, as I said, by the very poor reconstruction program, and then fueled even more by the drugs issue, because everyone is being bribed by the traffickers, you know, to allow them to traffic heroin, etc. You need a president who's going to build up capacity, who's going to deal with corruption, who's going to deal with drugs, and who's going to get tough, basically, you know, with his own people. The last thing that I think is needed is what I hinted on earlier, which is a regional strategy. Now, I think, you know, as I said, I think it's been very productive that just 6 weeks in office, this administration is trying to consult with all the neighboring countries. Now, what do I mean by a regional strategy? And if you... if you'd like to read more on this, I've written a piece for Foreign Affairs in December, a long piece that came out, which is called The Great Game, along with a colleague, Barnett Rubin. It's gratifying to see that a lot of these points have been taken on board. Everyone today, from Joe Biden to Hillary Clinton to Obama, is talking about a regional strategy. Now, there are three aspects to this regional strategy that I outlined. The first thing, as I explained, is you need to bring all the neighboring countries of Afghanistan to the table with the Afghans and with perhaps, you know, the big powers to agree to end their interference in Afghanistan and to agree to help stabilize Afghanistan. That means the Pakistanis have to stop harboring the Taliban, Iran has to stop harboring extremist elements, the Central Asians have to stop, and Russia has to stop funding northern warlords, the warlords which are adjacent to Central Asia, etc., etc. And this is not going to happen overnight. It's going to happen over a period of time. But you certainly need the neighbors to stop interference in Afghanistan. And remember, the Afghans are really fed up with this because their memory is that in the 1990s, the civil war that went on for 10 years, which led to the Taliban, you know, taking over the regime, that civil war was fueled by the outsiders. Pakistan was backing the Taliban. Iran and India were backing the Northern Alliance. Other regional countries were backing other people. So the first thing is stopping this interference in Afghanistan. But this is interlinked, and the problem is that all these countries have mutual bilateral problems with each other, of which the classic, of course, is India and Pakistan. How are you going to get India and Pakistan to stop their rivalry in Afghanistan unless you first resolve the India-Pakistan issue, which is basically over Kashmir? So how are you going to get to Iran when the U.S. has no relations with Iran? So you have to talk to, you know, the Americans have to talk to Iran. How are you going to get to the Central Asians unless you talk to Russia and you get Russia and the Central Asians on one, because Russia is really the dominating power in Central Asia? So what I'm saying here, the second level of this kind of diplomatic activity has to be a U.S. diplomatic initiative to try and resolve bilateral issues between these countries. If you can get a proper dialogue process on Kashmir between India and Pakistan, then you can ask both these countries to start talking to each other about their mutual suspicions and rivalries in Kabul and Afghanistan and end it. The Americans have to talk to Iran. And I'm very glad to see that Iran is going to be invited to this meeting by Hillary Clinton at the end of March. I suggested in this article was that on Afghanistan, Iran is already on your side, simply. Iran hates the Taliban. The Taliban are a Sunni fundamentalist movement which are trying to undermine the Sunni minorities in Iran. Iran is a majority Shia country, and the Taliban have victimized Shias in Afghanistan because they hate the Shias, the Afghan Shias, just as the Taliban in Pakistan are trying to kill Pakistani Shias. So Iran has every reason to... But Iran has been completely left on the sidelines. Whether it was military decision making, whether it was economic reconstruction, Iran has a very big economic rebuilding program for Afghanistan. But it's been completely left out of the UN and the Europeans and the others. You know, all the economic forums that are around reconstruction in Afghanistan. Iran is a member, but has really been ignored, and that's because of the American policy. So you need Iran on every front, whatever you're talking about, whether it's military, Taliban, terrorism, economics, etc. So I think that would be a crucial part. You need to talk to Russia and the Central Asians. As you know, Russia is playing very hard to get at the moment. Russia is trying to extract all sorts of concessions from the Americans on NATO, on missile defense, on other issues in Eastern Europe. Now, what I've suggested is that Afghanistan should be put into a separate basket from all these other issues. So with Iran, if you can discuss Afghanistan and get some cooperation going between the Americans and the Iranians without immediately starting to discuss putting the major strategic issues like Iran's nuclear bomb, relations with Israel, support for Hamas, Hezbollah, et cetera, into another basket. And because that will be obviously a much slower and a longer political process. Likewise with Russia and Central Asia. If you can put Afghan security into one basket and Russia's other problems with the Americans into another basket, maybe you can get a quicker decision on cooperation with the Russians and the Central Asians on Afghanistan. But in all this, I think that this administration will have to take some also very tough decisions and make them public. Now, the first is vis-a-vis Iran, that I think the U.S. will have to give some kind of public or private guarantees that the U.S. will not use Afghan soil to undermine Iran, which is precisely what the Bush administration was doing. And in other words, that the U.S. will not try and conduct regime change in Tehran, either through its American troops in Afghanistan and possibly even its American troops in Iraq. I think Iran is looking for that kind of minimal security for itself and understanding. So, I think this is a big issue. This will obviously be opposed by the conservatives in the United States and, by the Republicans, etc., but it needs to be done. Likewise, I think the Americans need to assure Russia and the Central Asians that the Americans are not seeking permanent military bases in Central Asia. As you know, the Americans have bases in Central Asia, that these bases will be short, for as long as the Afghan war continues and that they're needed, they will be there, but after that, they will be withdrawn. Thirdly, I think the Americans need to involve China in a very dramatic way in Afghanistan. China has money. It has an enormous stake in stabilizing. It shares a border with Afghanistan. It has a Islamic extremist problem. And not only that, it can become a major factor for investment and development because China is desperately in need of raw materials. Afghanistan is full of minerals. China has just signed the largest deal, which would give Afghanistan something like $3 billion over the next 10 years to develop. China wants to extract copper from a copper belt in Afghanistan. Now, you can imagine, I mean, if you're extracting copper from Afghanistan, you would need to build roads and railways and housing and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So this would be of enormous benefit if China was involved in both decision-making as well as economic reconstruction. China, again, has been kept on the periphery by the Bush administration. But again, I think the Chinese would need to be reassured that the Americans are not seeking a permanent presence either in Afghanistan or in Central Asia, that once this issue has, you know, stabilized, the Americans would start pulling out. Now, I don't believe the Americans want to stay in Afghanistan just as much as they don't want to stay in Iraq. And that is precisely what Obama got voted in upon, was to pull out of Iraq. Now, finally, you know, let me just touch that. I think I talked about, you know, what Obama needs to do. We can talk about Pakistan later, but my time is running out. But let me just say that Pakistan presents perhaps far more difficult options. What to do, but you know, when you have a political leadership that refuses to stop its internecine fighting, how do you give the Pakistan aid, or how, you know, etc.? What kind of economic package can you give, and how can you make sure that it's going to be properly monitored and administered, and it's not going to end up being sort of used to fuel corruption and sort of incompetence in the government? And thirdly, how do you persuade the Pakistan army, which runs the country's foreign policy and runs the nuclear program, how do you persuade the Pakistan army to move away from this kind of obsession with India and to retrain its forces for counterinsurgency and deal with these issues of Pakistani Taliban and the threat that they pose? The fact is that you know, something like one quarter of Pakistani territory today is not under the control of the state in Baluchistan and the Northwest Frontier Province. And the more this happens, the more Pakistan is going to move more rapidly into a state of meltdown, economic, militarily, fundamentalism, politically, all at every level. And nobody can ignore the seventh largest country in the world to be in a state of meltdown. Now, having said all this, I think the difficult problem for Obama is going to be how to sell this to the American people. He came in on a kind of peace ticket, not on a war ticket. He came in not expecting, I think, the depth of the economic crisis. Or everything that I've spelt out here needs money. You know, whether it's your foreign policy or your troops or whatever it is, it needs money. It's going to be very difficult to sell a commitment to Afghanistan and Pakistan, but I think it is absolutely critical. It's critical for the security of the United States. It's critical for your own homeland security. It's critical for Europe, the fact that, you know, Al-Qaeda is spreading there. It's critical also because of the nuclear factor, the fact that Pakistan is a nuclear power, and nobody can afford to see Pakistan melt down in this way. And secondly, finally, it's really critical if you want to stop the expansion of Al Qaeda, and you don't want to see these local jihadi groups become more and more radicalized and become more and more part of this global jihad. It becomes vitally important that the issues of Afghanistan and Pakistan are addressed as quickly as possible in the most positive way. Thank you very much indeed.
Our thanks to Ahmed Rashid for his comments today. My name is Jeff Bell. I am the co-anchor of the afternoon news at KCBS Radio in San Francisco, 740 AM and 106.9 FM. And I will be conducting the Q&A portion of the program. We have a number of questions that have come out of your talk this afternoon, Mr. Rashid, and we'll try to go through as many of these as possible. One of the questions that came up from several people was regarding the president's call to talk to various factions that the Bush administration chose not to talk with. And a two-part question for you to start things off here. The first one is, in terms of the Obama administration's need to sell this approach to the American people, What does he need to convey to the American people about the need to speak with some of these perhaps more moderate elements of the Taliban? And also, if you would address a question that came up specifically about the fact that even the most moderate factions of the Taliban exclude women. So a large portion of this population would be excluded right off the top, half the population, for example. So let's start there.
Well, you know, all the studies show that insurgency since the Second World War, no insurgency has been crushed just through military means. Insurgencies have been crushed or, you know, suppressed through a mixture of military, dialogue, economic, etc. So I think, you know, it is that's the first kind of reason to talk to these people. Secondly, as I described to you, I think a lot of Taliban are not there to fight the Americans. A lot of Taliban are there for a variety of local, domestic, family, tribal, clan, whatever reasons. And to lump them along with everyone, along with Al-Qaeda and all the rest of it, I think is not a sensible idea, because you're only increasing the base of recruitment for Al-Qaeda rather than decreasing it. You want to try and peel off these Taliban so that, you know, you can isolate Al-Qaeda and the extremists. Thirdly, as far as selling this, I think it is absolutely, you know, I think this can be sold, I mean simply. I think this can be sold to the American people. It certainly can be sold to the Afghans. This is what they want. It can be sold to the Muslim world generally, because this is also what they want. I think it would be a very productive part of it, the shift in U.S. policy towards the entire Muslim world. If the U.S. expressed its willingness to talk to all these nationalist extremist groups, and that includes people like the Kashmiri militants, Hamas, Hezbollah, etc. Now, on the question of women, well, you know, 6,000, the Karzai government has actually had a dialogue process with the Taliban. 6,000 Taliban have actually come down and surrendered their weapons and all the rest of it. Now, perhaps with the others, you would not be talking about surrender. But I don't think you would be talking here about there is a constitution, there is a rule of law in Afghanistan for what it's worth, there is a justice system. You would not be negotiating major compromises such as, for example, girls' education. You would not be discussing, you would not be saying, the Taliban would not be allowed to say, well, we don't allow girls' education and you have to put it away. I think, you know, there are huge variety of means. And the example comes from some of these leading Taliban commanders who've come in. Some of these Taliban commanders have become governors of provinces or police chiefs of the province or district chiefs. So what do? You give them a political job. And when you give them a political job, you give their clan or their tribe or their family political jobs also. So it's a kind of, patronage, you know. You give them compensation. You allow them to run for parliament. I can't remember, in the 2005 elections, it was at least a dozen Taliban, former Taliban, ran for the elections. None of them won, by the way, but they were allowed to run for the election. So there are elections coming up in August. You can allow Taliban who come back into the fold to run for elections. They can set up their own group or party, which, I mean, has to accept the minimum level of the Afghan constitution. So again, I don't think, I mean, you know, the women issue would not be women's education, women in the workforce, you know, these kinds of issues would not be there for denouncing or renouncing.
We've had a couple of questions come up regarding the creation of Pashtunistan, if I'm saying that correctly, a separate country out of Afghanistan that might, in fact, remove some of the more extremist population from more moderate factions in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Well, as you know, the Pashtun population straddles the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. There are about 10 or 12 million Pashtuns in Afghanistan and about 25 million in Pakistan. I don't believe that the Taliban want to create a separate Pashtun, although most of the Taliban are Pashtun. I don't think the Taliban want to create a separate Pashtun state. They are genuinely want to, you know, conquer Afghanistan, drive out the Americans, and they want to conquer Pakistan and turn it into a Taliban state. That is their military aim. It is not just to Talibanize the Pashtuns. They want to Talibanize their respective countries, all the ethnic groups that live in those countries. Pashtunistan was a factor in the 60s and 70s. It was largely a left-wing movement, both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, led by Marxists who wanted to create a separate ethnic state based on the Pashtuns. But today, I don't think that is really on anyone's agenda. And secondly, of course, everyone is deeply aware that if you raise the issue of Pashtunistan, on whether you're Afghan or Pakistani, you're talking about splitting these two countries. You're talking about the partitioning, the repartitioning of Pakistan, which would be extremely dangerous, because then the Baloch, the Sindhis, the other ethnic groups, which also have big differences with the center, would also step up their separatism. And likewise in Afghanistan, you'd be talking about other ethnic groups perhaps wanting to split. So I don't think it's a big issue at the moment.
You referenced the upcoming elections in Afghanistan. From your perspective, should the U.S. remain neutral or take more of an aggressive stand in terms of how those might play out?
Well, you know, right now there's a major constitutional crisis in that Karzai's term of office expires in May, and elections can't be held because of security issues until August. And the big issue is, does Karzai wants to stay on as president until the elections? Naturally, he would be an incumbent president, and the big fear then would be that he doesn't rig the elections as an incumbent president. The opposition and the opposition candidates who want to stand against him want him out. They want a caretaker government to look after the government until the elections, and the elections to be held under a kind of neutral caretaker government. And I at the moment, I don't know how this is going to be resolved, but it looks likely that probably Karzai is going to stay. I think it's very important that the American position remains neutral. I think the moment the Americans put their hand on someone, or bless someone, as it were, it would destroy the whole meaning of that election. And it would really make all the neighboring countries very suspicious, because actually all the neighboring countries are going to have favorite candidates too. By the way, Iran, Pakistan, the Russians, they're going to be, having there. So I think it's very important that the Americans aim with NATO and with the allies for a genuinely free and fair, relatively rig-free election.
For our radio listeners, we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We are talking again with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. Mr. Rashid, weigh in, if you would, on what the U.S. can do in terms of aiding Afghan refugees.
Well, I think this is one of the huge tragedies of Afghanistan. You know, after 9/11, 5 million Afghan refugees came back to Afghanistan, 3 million from Pakistan, 2 million from Iran, plus a huge diaspora from, America and Europe and other places. And these refugees literally came back, 80% of them wanted to go back to their villages. And they couldn't, because there was absolutely no plans to invest in agriculture. And that, to me, was the biggest American failure, the failure to invest in agriculture, because that had such hugely negative spin-offs. The drugs business started. These refugees didn't go back to the villages. They went to the cities and formed this kind of huge lumpen, out-of-job, lumpen proletariat, if you like, jobless people who then either joined the Taliban or turned to crime and kidnapping and all this kind of thing. So the crisis with these refugees is still not resolved. There are still 3 million refugees outside Afghanistan, 2 million in Pakistan and 1 million in Iran. And the Pakistanis and the Iranians are desperate to push these refugees back into Afghanistan. And the Afghan government is saying, no more, please, because we don't have the support, we don't have the money, we don't have the facilities to resettle these refugees in their villages. Because there's half of them would go back to grow poppy, or a lot of them would go and join the Taliban because, there would be no investment. So the lack of funding and the lack of a strategic program for bringing refugees back, resettling them properly, investing into agriculture so that there would be some meaning for these families to go back has really not happened.
We've had a variety of questions come in, asked in a variety of different ways, all getting at the same question, really, which is, help us understand the level of support for the Taliban within Pakistan, amongst the average resident, for example. Is it based on fear? What are some of the factors that would persuade someone in Pakistan either to support or be opposed to the Taliban's growth?
I think the driving force for the Taliban is fear. You know, the Pakistani Taliban have used absolutely horrifying tactics over the last 3 or 4 years. They have really refined the acts of, you know, beheading and videos and, you know, suicide bombings and kids as young as 11 and 12 being used in car bombings. It has been, I would say, the tactics used have been far more terrifying than even what the Afghan Taliban have used inside Afghanistan. So I think that has been a major factor. They have developed a very methodical, sustained program of how they penetrate into villages and large towns, even into Peshawar now, which is the capital of the Northwest Frontier Province. And what they do is, you know, I mean, they move in, they start harassing girls, and they blow up girls' schools. They stop music and videos. They smash television sets. They set up such a climate of fear among, and then they start executing people who they consider to be government spies or government agents. Particularly, they execute policemen, administration people, judges, people who, teachers, who reflect the state and who reflect, you know, a modernism in any form or the other. Thirdly, they've now been in some of the areas, they've been demanding there's forced conscription. Every family is told that you have to, on the pain of death, you have to deliver one able-bodied male adult to the Taliban force. So I think that, but at the other level, I will say that there is a lot of confusion in Pakistan, and this is what makes it very difficult. First of all, there's a lot of anti-Americanism in Pakistan. Many Pakistanis feel that the war in Afghanistan is all because, you know, the American troops are there, that and the war has spread to Pakistan as a result of American actions, and that the Pakistani Taliban are not a creation of Pakistan, but are a creation of America. Now, this kind of, you know, conspiracy theory or perverted logic really, anti-Americanism means that many people in their anti-Americanism become sympathetic to extremism and become sympathetic to the religious parties. That these secular parties who want democracy, this is all a big mistake and a big fraud. And anyway, they're fighting each other and they're killing each other. They're not looking after the country. What we need is an Islamic system. What we need are Islamic parties to rule and run the country. So in Pakistan, perhaps unlike, again, in Afghanistan, there's a big gray area. You know, in Afghanistan, it's fairly black and white. I mean, you have the bulk of the population who may be angry with the Americans, but who hate the Taliban. In Pakistan, you have a large chunk of the population, the largest chunk by far, who are anti-Taliban and who don't believe in any of this kind of Taliban interpretation of Islam. But you do have people who are sympathetic to the message that they bring, which is anti-Americanism. And you have elements in the media, for example, who are sympathetic to the Taliban. And this can be very dangerous because this fuels, obviously, more and more Taliban sympathy.
A question about al-Qaeda and whether or not it's misleading to refer to al-Qaeda as an organization with branches in various countries as opposed to more of an abstract idea. What I gather this question is trying to get at is just how logistically viable is al-Qaeda these days?
Well, I think it's, you know, as I've tried to describe to you, I think it is very logistically viable. It is an abstract idea, but it is also an organization. I think a lot of the strategic planning for the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban is being done by al-Qaeda or in consultation with al-Qaeda. Why? Because a lot of the strategic planning is dealing with safe havens for al-Qaeda. If al-Qaeda can develop safer and safer havens in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, they can bring the Europeans over for training. They can bring people from, which they are. You know, I was in Germany recently. The Germans are trying to track 50 Germans who have been trained by al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Now, they can only track 12 of them. In other words, they only know, and some of these are German Turks, some of these are German Central Asians, but some of these are white Germans who have converted to Islam and who have then gone and trained in you know. Now, they can track only 12 of them. They don't know where the others are. And I think, you know, if you take Britain, where, you know, Britain says that they're tracking something like 2,000 militants in Britain, many of them, of whom are of British Pakistani origin, but many of them who are of Bangladeshi origin, of Indian origin, or even white converts who have, or black converts who have converted to Islam. So it is a very, very, you know, this is not an abstract idea. If you can pull a bunch of Germans or a bunch of Brits or a bunch of Danes or Dutch, you know, to the Pakistan border, you have the mechanisms to do that. You have the funding to do that. You can you have the trainers to train them. You then have the ability to send them out, all in the midst of, you know, American drones and spies, satellites, and all this kind of thing. It means you have a functioning organization to be able to do all that.
I want to move the conversation for a couple of minutes to the India-Pakistan conflict. Do you believe that a potential leadership of Pakistan would willingly begin a nuclear war with India and or the West that would also destroy their own country?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think, you know, in his last... certainly there have been two very close shaves, both during the Musharraf era. Musharraf was a very rash, brash military figure who had very little idea of politics or the economy or the international repercussions. We had, you know, he instigated the war in Kargil in 1999, which led to a nuclear clash with India. And then immediately after 9/11, he allowed militants to again infiltrate into Kashmir, and they bombed the Indian parliament, which led to the standoff for 1 year with India, a military standoff, which again nearly led to you know, the threat of nuclear war. But I would say that after 2004, there was, I think, Musharraf realized that, you know, Pakistan cannot defeat India as such. And there was a peace process that started. If you've read the recent story in The New Yorker by Steve Call, there was a back channel that was also started, which was to try and resolve the Kashmir issue. And I really do believe that, you know, before he left, there had been real progress between India and Pakistan. What has happened subsequently is that what Musharraf failed to do is that he failed to carry the army with him. He himself was army chief. He did not carry his generals with him. And what is really needed towards Pakistan's attitude to India is a real paradigm shift. I mean, you need a strategic U-turn by the military to understand that the real threat is not India today. The real threat are the Pakistani Taliban and the growth of extremism in Pakistan. And after Musharraf left, I think the military has kind of reverted back to some extent to this old kind of obsession, you know, with India. The military does recognize that there is a domestic threat, but it still balances off that by saying that, but the biggest threat is still India. And until we move away from that, I don't think we're going to see nuclear war, but the danger of this kind of conventional hot pursuit, conventional conflict, is still very much there.
For our radio listeners, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And again, we are speaking with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid. In the remaining minutes that we have, I'd like to just pass along a potpourri of questions that have come in that are very specific, if you would. One is this. Is Canada's engagement in Afghanistan a model for the U.S. to follow? Who? Canada.
The Canadians have done a great job in Afghanistan, no question. Small country, not, you know, small population, small budget. Afghanistan today is the largest single. It dwarfs all expenses of their foreign policy, their aid policy, and their military policy. They've contributed, I think, far more than their weight would have demanded. So I think it's been very productive, what the Canadians have done. But, of course, they are now saying that they're going to pull out their troops from southern Afghanistan. It's more than 2,000 troops they've got in 2011. And the U.S. is very keen to try and work out some arrangement whereby Canada can stay. I think the Canadian model, I wish it had been followed by more European countries in NATO. by more of NATO partners. You know, in the whole, NATO comprises of 26 countries. You've only got a handful of, all of them have troops in Afghanistan. But the majority of them have caveats, that is, restrictions on their troops being able to fight. You only have a handful of countries, Canada, Britain, the Dutch, a handful of countries whose troops are actually fighting the Taliban. The rest of the troops saying we are peacekeeping forces, we are, you know, we're not going to fight. So I think Canada's example is a hugely positive example for NATO and for the Americans.
What do you see as the risk of a terrorist attack in Egypt? A terrorist attack in Egypt, how probable is that?
Well, I think it's very possible and very probable also. I mean, we have had in the recent few years terrorist attacks in Egypt. Clearly, Egypt's involvement, you know, with the peace process with Israel is hated by the militants. Mubarak is hated by the militants, and for that he's to blame partly himself, because he's just utterly failed to introduce any kind of political reform or economic reform in Egypt. And there's rising tide of unrest against Mubarak, which is fueling fueling militancy in Egypt, I think. As we know, the number two of al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is an Egyptian himself. He remains very committed to bringing about, political change in Egypt. A large component of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is Egyptian. There's a lot of traffic between them and Egypt itself. So the threat is there.
Does al-Qaeda have a presence in Ireland, and what is the implication in regard to the resurgent IRA activity?
I have no idea. That really stumps me. I can't answer that. I just have no idea.
Fair enough. A question about the Caspian Sea oil, that there is apparently a proposal for a pipeline that would run down eastern Afghanistan, where there are four U.S. bases, to the port of southwestern corner of Pakistan. Implications of that project?
No, I mean, you know, in my earlier Taliban book in before 9/11, I mean, there was a plan by a U.S. company, which was on paper it was very positive, that you would transport Central Asian oil from Turkmenistan across Afghanistan and feed Pakistan and India, who are extremely energy hungry. Of course, the fallacy of the plan at that time was that there was a civil war going on in Afghanistan between the Taliban and the Northern Alliance, and it was impossible to do something, and that plan fizzled out. Ultimately, this plan is very feasible. It would bring great prosperity to Afghanistan, because Afghanistan could charge, you know, transport fees and all the rest of it. It would provide oil to Afghanistan. And, of course, it would set Afghanistan up as a kind of, you know, along with the pipeline would be roads and towns and, you know, industry and all the rest of it. So it would be a great boon. But you're not going to be able to do this until you get peace in Afghanistan. Until you come to some kind of agreement, settlement, etc., nobody's going to build any such pipeline in the midst of a war, and that remains. So I mean, it's still very far away, but again, I mean, it's the idea itself is very good.
I suppose this question gets at somewhat of a conspiracy theory in terms of the drug trade. We've addressed that. Certainly drug smuggling has benefited the Taliban and al-Qaeda. The question is, do we as the United States look the other way on this because CIA assets, potentially the Northern Alliance, for example, are also benefiting from this drug trade? Is there a larger conspiracy of some kind?
No, I don't see a conspiracy. I just see massive corruption. I mean, you know, and you know, drugs money is so... I mean, you're talking about qualified Afghans who have salaries of maybe $200 or $150 a month. Now, you know, and the drug trafficker comes and offers you 50 times that or 500 times that. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, the Afghans want to educate their kids. They want to, you know, have a decent life. I mean, you know, so what drugs has done, it has basically corrupted the Afghan administration, because the profits from drug money are so enormous. I mean, if you're providing 93% of the world's heroin, this is not a joke. I mean, you can imagine what the money being generated by this is. And paying off Afghan administrators or Afghan police or Afghan officers, I mean, it's a drop in the bucket for what they are actually earning in real terms. Because the real problem now is that Al-Qaeda is actually trafficking drugs, and so are the Taliban, outside Afghanistan. They have become part of the trafficking network. You know, back in 2002, 2003, the Taliban were reaping in money from the farmers, which was a pittance. They were maybe making 50 million or 100 million a year by taxing the farmers growing. Now they're taxing the transporters, and they are part of the trafficking. And as you know, drugs multiplies. The more further it gets, the closer it gets to the market, the higher the price goes up. So if you're involved in shipping drugs out of Afghanistan to Dubai or to Central Asia or to Moscow or to Turkey, obviously the price you can demand there is phenomenal. And that's precisely what's happened. Why the Taliban, Al-Qaeda have much more funds at their disposal through drugs is that they're able to reap now the benefits of trafficking.
We are unfortunately down to just our last question here, and I thought perhaps we should wrap this up with a topic that everybody is talking about today and you have touched on as well, which is the global recession. And if you would address briefly for us how that will impact this nation-building effort.
Look, I mean, you know, obviously it's going to impact it hugely. But I think that the key to this is America has to end the unilateralism of the Bush period and accept a much more multilateral global, whether you're dealing with the recession, you need your partners, you need a common strategy to deal with this because it's a global recession. America is not going to come up for an answer with America, for Americans, whatever America does is going to impact the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is going to demand cooperation with America. So you need partners, and you do have countries with money, frankly. Japan has an enormous, actually it has a huge surplus lying in the bank right now for Afghanistan, which it wants to use as part of this strategy. And the Japanese foreign minister has just been to Washington. The Chinese have money. The Arabs have money. And it's being very, I have been very critical of the Gulf Arab countries for their utter failure to actually invest productively in Afghanistan over the last 7 years, despite the fact that they have been part of the problem, because many of these Arab countries were actually funding the Taliban before 9/11 and funding Al-Qaeda even before 9/11, as you well know. So they owe it to the Afghan people to help fund reconstruction in Afghanistan. So I think it's all about multilateralism. Are you going to reach out to your allies? And the bottom line, as I've talked about, is that you have to involve these countries in sharing decision-making. You cannot go to these countries and say, here is the decision. Here, we, America, have made the decision. We, America, have made the policy. And now we expect you to cough up. Well, these countries are saying, I'm sorry. We have to be part of the decision because we don't agree with what, A, B, or C of what you're doing. So I think the Obama administration is on the right track. They are trying to involve as many countries in this policy review that is coming up. They're talking to everyone. And I think that's terribly important, to give countries a stake in Afghan policy, to give countries a stake in what emerges in Afghanistan.
Mr. Rashid, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Ahmed Rashid, Pakistani journalist and writer, senior fellow on international policy at the Pacific Council, and author of Descent into Chaos, U.S. Policy, and the Failure of Nation Building in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Central Asia. We thank our audience both here and on the radio today. I'm Jeff Bell, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.